Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
To think that there's somebody there that's being questioned by police, they can't get anything out of it. When all these things are pointing to him, and you know, from Delser and Justin, but like that they don't talk or that they can't get to talk, it's really frustrating. I think it's even more frustrating than the fuck up with the media, the fuck up with the police. And,
man, if I was a cop, I mean, that's what I'd be thinking. That a missing person, you know, probably was last at the house. I mean, whatever catalyst clearly happened there, I had set the whole thing down right off the bat. But they didn't. So that was probably the start of it.
See, there is a definite sense of how fucked up this is, and wanting to be careful about what you said, because he might be on a vacation, you know, for a fucking month. I mean, the guy stole the safe, or broke the safe, didn't steal it, but they took the safe because he didn't want to find, you know, pot and stuff inside. Well, they ended up getting it back. But there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on to try to keep this a missing persons thing instead of a pot thing. It wasn't because, like I said, after the second day you knew you weren't going to find him out there. I knew it.
Do you know anything about that? Anything about
standing
on a pig farm up in
Point
Ed?
No. That's ridiculous. No.
Do you think it's weird that his body's never been found?
I think that's weird in any missing person's case, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Believe me, I just don't know.
1 minute remaining.
Hey, I have one question, and then this is actually a question from Margie. The last time you saw Amos, how was he?
Hello, and welcome to episode 51 of The Vanished. 27-year-old Amos Mortier was last seen on November 8th, 2004. It initially appeared that something had happened to Amos while he was out with his dog Gnosis, but when no trace of Amos was found in the area surrounding his home, suspicions quickly fell on his friends, which changed this investigation into more than just a missing persons investigation and into a large-scale drug investigation. But out of all the people in his life who had the motive and opportunity to harm Amos, this is part 3 of Amos Mortier's story.
In episode 2 of Where is Amos Mortier, family and friends of Amos descend on 5078 Lacey Road to search for Amos, who has now been missing for a week. One of Amos' closest friends, Jacob Faulkner, is arrested and accused of his murder, while another friend, Brent Delser, comes under increasing scrutiny for his potential role in the disappearance. But it's a mysterious devil in Prada who steals the show by telling Detective Shannon Sheila Morgan that Amos had planned to confront a man named Big Jake Statfeld, Destin says, has stolen $90,000 from Amos. In this episode, the investigation stalls, leaving those caught up in the dragnet to try and flesh out the mystery of what happened to Amos for themselves. On a side note, as many of you are aware, I am writing and co-producing a feature documentary about this case. We are currently trying to raise $30,000 to finish production on the film, which is about 40% complete. We are close to reaching one-third of our goal, so please support this film. So please, go to Kickstarter.com and watch the trailer to our film, and please contribute. We have special prizes available to the Vanished listeners, including What Happened to Amos Skullcaps, movie posters, bumper stickers, t-shirts, and 10 pages of my handwritten production notes for this long overdue episode. So thank you, and enjoy.
Amos Mortier was born on April 28, 1977, to Margie Milutinovich and Terry Boot Mortier. The couple was together for 15 years, but never married.
How old are you?
25, but I was maturity-wise 13. Mm.
She had wanted to give Amos a natural childbirth, but due to a previously unnoticed complication, Margie ended up having to have a C-section.
This is something that they should have known before I was in labor for 3 days. So finally on the third day around 1:30, 1:50, they took x-rays and wheeled me into surgery for a C-section.
In the 1970s, the procedure wasn't for the faint of heart.
They don't cut you now like they cut you back then. It was like a, you know, up north, they took the chainsaw.
Amos's father, Boot, came from a well-known family in Spooner, known for their Christmas trees, but he largely kept to himself.
I'm just telling you a little bit about poor Amos's beginning, because all this, you know, affected him, because I was, like, out of it. And, like, I really, you know, I was going to breastfeed, and, like, that was, like, you know, I tried, but poor Amos, you know. Oh, baby, I never took care of children, ever. It was horrible for him, as frightening it was for me. I was afraid of him.
And Boo was still there with you the whole time?
No, he went up north to go smelting.
Okay.
Yeah.
While you were in labor?
After I delivered. Okay. And he went up north and went smelting.
The new mother found herself alone and also afraid because no one had taught her about the sacrifices parenthood would bring.
No, he wasn't really there. He pretty much, his life didn't change after that. Mine did a 180. And it's pretty, you know, intense having a child. You don't, you know, as soon as you get pregnant, then nobody tells you, like, your life's going to change 180 degrees. His didn't really, but mine certainly did. But poor Amos, yeah, because, like, I was afraid to even hold him. I never even really held a baby before. So, like, I remember wrapping him in, like, the little blanket things, and that army nurse comes in and goes, that's too loose. And she's, like, wrapping it up, like, really tight, like a burrito, you know. It's like, but back then they didn't have the classes, and they didn't have all the stuff they have now, which I needed, because I didn't know anything about taking care of a baby. So poor Amos, you know, like I said, he was, had to go through all the me, not knowing anything.
Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500.
27 years later, Margie entered every parent's worst nightmare when she learned on November 14th, 2004, that Amos had gone missing a week earlier. Each day that week, she called into the job she had recently begun.
I didn't tell you this, like, when I got that call from Seneca that Sunday night, I was on a contract job at WPS. I think I had only been there on another contract, and I called my person, and I said, I'm not coming in today, my son's missing. So, yeah, that's okay. I said, no, you don't, my son is missing. It's like you tell people that, and they don't get it. And so, yeah, I just dropped my job, and I was out at the search every day.
As Margie learned to be a different kind of mom, others in Amos's life figured out how to grapple with the fallout on their own. Amos's longtime friend, Brent Delzer, sold high-quality marijuana for Amos since the late 90s. When interviewed by Nathan in 2008, Brent spoke wistfully of his former vocation.
What you did to fucking make sure that you didn't have to end up in the quagmire bullshit that this society has by and large become. I want to explore my own interests. So did he. I don't want to fucking have my interests destroyed by freaking some mundane bullshit workaday motherfucking thing. Very few people get to fucking wake up in the morning and be like, wow, I love what I do, you know? Actually, it's like being a person that loves to write. Like, I respect you, you know? Like, you get to wake up and say, wow, I get to, like, pursue this cool thing, figure out this puzzle, write about it. That's cool. But very few people get that. All we did was we didn't want to fit into the bullshit that makes us not get to do that, you know?
Brent speaks to the frustrations of having gone legit while awaiting his federal indictment for trafficking marijuana.
I want to learn every day. A day that you don't get to learn something new is a wasted freaking day. As an example, like, of where I'm at now, How many things do you get to learn a day when you're out in friggin' 8 below 0 windshields trying to wash a goddamn window? Yeah, you get to really put your mind on your old intellectual pursuits at that point. Now you get to realize, holy fuck, I just lost feeling in my fingers. No, there it is. It's a burning, horrible sensation.
In the years following the disappearance, as state prosecutors wrapped up the John Doe investigation and federal authorities began a grand jury investigation, Amos's disappearance became the stuff of urban legend. The speculation continues to this day. We're going to hear some of those theories now from those who knew him. Some, like Brent Delzer, question whether Amos was even murdered.
Based on the evidence that can be shown to me on what happened, it's as likely to take my aliens and this woman on Alpha Centauri right now than it is to anything else. I mean, what can you show me that says that? Am I a fanciful, like, airhead that's bleeding crazy? No, not really, but I say that just to say, you don't know what happened, you know? It was an immaculate scene. Like, there's no, that's a thought. I mean, you say these people, well, who are they? You know, who are these crazy people that just are able to tell, I mean, is it Black Hawk Down? They're just coming in and like have nav sats and freaking... Just like, go, go, go. Confidence is hot. No. What happened? I mean...
Amos's friend and former neighbor Keith Burney says he was convinced that Amos, in essence, had become roadkill that a very lucky motorist took with him or her without being seen.
You have to understand, I was convinced up until almost the end that he had actually run after his dog and got ran over. I thought, well, 2 weeks before he even knew that this was going on, the dog's loose. He could have been hit in the road. Somebody picked him up, put him in a pickup truck rather than wait for a cop. It rained for a few weeks. You're not going to see blood. You know, I was firmly convinced that he was accidentally killed by someone who didn't want to face the cop for probably close to 2 years. And the more and the cop came back and talked to me some more, and it did seem, well, actually what convinced me was the $90,000 thing.
Frustrations with Morgan's slow-moving investigation deprived even their own suspects of any confidence that police work was being done efficiently. 5 months passed before search warrants were executed on the property of their primary suspect, Big Jake Stadfeld. Reporters and news crews descended on the Inferno nightclub that December, following Amos's disappearance, for a fundraiser to help raise reward money for information leading to Amos's whereabouts. Organized by Brent Delzer, it featured musicians like Marty Frank, who performs under the name Abel Kane. The attendance benefited from pre-night publicity. The usual Inferno crew was there, along with others from the search. Due to the rising tensions between Amos's friends and law enforcement, Margie asked Morgan and Bon Giovanni to take the night off, that the get-together was for family and friends.
Ken and Morgan and Bon Giovanni were both there, even though Margie said, don't show up. This is for, you know, his friends and family.
I went to the first thing at the, where was it, what's that club?
The Inferno.
Yeah, I went to the first deal at the Inferno. I didn't go back to the first anniversary because they were so steeped in that Amos has got amnesia, and we know you're still alive, and I had come to the conclusion that one way or another he wasn't alive, you know, mainly because of his dog. I could see Amos probably cutting all of the ties, but he wouldn't have had, if he wanted to disappear, he wouldn't have had to let his dog go. He could have just left it at the kennel and left it at the lot.
Suspicions around Dirk preceded police involvement. Amos's friend Dominic told a grand jury that Dirk was concerned about Amos long before anyone knew that something was wrong. Other friends also pointed out that Dirk was the first inside the house and had made several trips there.
Here's another setup story. Some of the people around Amos, I think, are fairly questionable. A guy named Derek or Dirk. Amos moved into a house on Reski a couple years back. And when I went over there, I think he introduced me to this guy. I don't particularly remember what the guy looks like, but I remember him saying the name. And then I never saw the guy again. And he explained that this guy was his roommate and on the lease. When Amos moved out to the Lacey Road address, he explained to me that the same guy was on the lease with them. Never saw the guy at his house. Never saw any of that stuff. I mean, Amos' stuff was there, but no one else's stuff was there. And I don't think the guy ever even showed up there. Now, the police said that they interviewed this guy and his girlfriend. And Shannon Jill Morgan said that actually, technically, the last people to see Amos was this guy and his girlfriend. And they went camping with Amos the weekend before he disappeared. I have talked to a few other people that I know that have met this Derek guy. And he's a really shady character. And was involved pretty heavily in selling heroin. He was actually arrested with 43 or 45 bags of heroin. Which isn't like crazy amount, but it's a lot. I mean, 4 or 5 grams will get you 10 years in federal prison there. And I think that this Derek guy, being an older gentleman, and I'm pretty sure he was deadhead, was somehow involved. Whether he was higher up, just perfectly even with Amos, or lower, or just a friend, you know, related to it. Somehow, obviously, even being on the lease, just, you know, it just raised some red flags for me, and his whole past.
Jacob Faulkner was particularly upset that the information he gathered on Dirk was met with a compliment from police. While Jacob had endured the indignities of investigators asking his family and past relations questions that implied that he was a pedophile. Early suspicion among detectives was that Jacob Faulkner was in love with Amos and murdered him in a jealous rage, though neither man is homosexual.
You know, they said, we got all these other guys way out on the East Coast, and they said, we even have all the people that were shipping it out here, the drivers. And that was part of the reason they wanted me to come down and look at some photos of these quote-unquote drivers to verify, you know, oh, I saw this guy at his house and whatnot. And so, you know, it started to seem like they were putting some type of incredible evidence on there. But I said, now, here lies my huge dilemma. Because I started putting two and two together. He said, we already got all these top guys. They're already in prison. And I'm like, well, if you already got these top guys, why are you going down the ladder, the smaller people? Well, you guys don't do that. That's not how the feds work. There's no way to get down to the, I mean, what's the fucking point? You're gonna, no, that's not it. Then they were like, well, we want to connect this murder. And I'm like, for one, you have really no evidence of murder at all. In fact, it's all hearsay that you guys have been spreading. And two, I suspect you know Amos is okay. And that's partially why you took Amos' mom out of the loop, because of her website. Because you guys think she was channeling untraceable information out to Amos in a remote area that can monitor his mom's site and other avenues like talking to people. So they cut off this flow of information going out so that none of the information about Amos' quote-unquote drug ties out east.
As others had more vaguely suggested, Jacob Faulkner also wondered whether Dirk had become a snitch for the DEA to dodge prison for a legal problem, but instead tipped Amos off.
But then there's another take that I have on it, and I told Amos' mom this. I may have even alluded to some of this to Jerry Becca in our little 15-minute conversation, but I think when Dirk got arrested for the heroin, he struck a plea deal to be an informant, which is why...
Well, his bus happened prior to the disappearance.
Yeah. I think it was years before, 2 or 3 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Quite some time. I'm not sure about that, but I seem to remember someone explained to me around the time that my state case was still going on about all that. So, and they had told me, I think they said it was like 2 or 3 years before that. Anyways,
I think he was an informant infiltrating Amos's ring of drug dealing. I think he either told Amos this or Amos found out and maybe something slipped on their camping trip and Amos decided to leave. And I truly, this is what I want to believe. This is, and a lot of things are
going to this. He wanted Gabby and Dirk and his girl.
Yeah.
At least before he won that thing.
Yeah. Supposedly, they were the last ones to actually see him. And now this is all hearsay. I can't even remember who told me this, and this is the sketchy thing is all this, you know, some of these conversations I remember very vividly, some of them not so vividly. So, you know, knowing that that fact is, it could be completely untrue. But, no, that's what I seem to remember right now. Is that someone told me that, and I think it was Shannon Shaw Morgan who actually told me that. So, I want him to be an informant because that to me smacks in the face that Amos is not dead and he is on the run. And I already know Amos to be very good at that. And I told the police this right off the bat. They said, before they even started talking about him being dead, one of the things they said to me was, where would he go? Would he go? How would he go? And I said, well, you guys probably already know this, but the reason he moved from Eau Claire to Madison, which is when he moved in with me and my roommate, was because he sold an undercover cop a quarter ounce of magic mushroom.
This rumor about Dirk's potential involvement in Amos's disappearance is gussied up with enough truth to give it flippers but not legs. For the record, he was not Amos's roommate at 5078 Lacey Road. He is an older gentleman and has worn his hair in a ponytail. In April 2004, he was given a 2-year suspended prison sentence, 33 months of probation, and 60 days in a jail work release program for one felony manufacturing and delivery of heroin in 2003.
Result of your interactions with Becca earlier that year, that you were still working with them and you were actually at a cave trying to talk to her, and you got the light from and just all on. That's why you went underground.
Oh my God.
So, that's far-fetched. I figured. I mean, a lot of it's far-fetched.
That's really far-fetched.
Wow, I never thought about that angle before.
That's quoted by, by a couple of people.
Wow. It's like,
I might as well tell you, this is one of my first thoughts, is that he went underground to join, a radical environmental group.
Dirk never fell under the suspicion of police, except maybe for Fitchburg Police Officer Sean Coffey. In his first statement taken by Officer Coffey, Dirk couldn't settle on whether Amos or himself drove to Kickapoo River Valley on November 6, 2004. He was still unsure about this in 2008.
I believe I drove, and Amos had left his vehicle at my house.
Dirk is as frustrated with how the investigation played out as anyone.
I suppose some of these DEA agents and FBI probably be pretty abrasive, and I can understand that. And I'm sure everyone involved in this case got a feel of it. But, there were times when I wanted to be on their side to try and figure out what's up with Amos. Because it seems like particularly Stadfeld hasn't said shit. Really bothersome. To think that there's somebody there that's being questioned by police, they can't get anything out of it. When all these things are pointing to him, and from Delser and Weston, but that they don't talk or that they can't get to talk, it's really frustrating. I think it's even more frustrating than the fuck ups with the media, the fuck ups with the police.
Investigators also didn't seem interested in Destin Lane. Despite Margie's bad feeling that she was somehow involved in the disappearance, Destin Lane is who told Detective Shannon Shiel Morgan that Amos planned to confront Big Jake over the $90,000 that Jake Stadfeld owed him. Destin Lane told Morgan that she had encouraged Amos to go to the police, but she didn't. Destin told Margie and Brent, however, that she told Amos he needed to do something about it. There were plenty of questions around her, if you remember from the last episode. Remember Destin's call to Margie for directions to Amos's house the day the search began? Margie later heard Destin say that she had been to Amos's house quite a few times. Then there was the question about how Destin had Margie's number when none of his friends could even find it.
So Dustin Lane's just kind of this mysterious figure at this point, right? Nobody really knows who she is. She calls Margie on November 15th, asking for directions to Amos's house. She goes out to the house. Nobody knows who she is. Brent Delzy doesn't want to let her in. She's like, I'm Tyler Lane's brother. Everyone's like, who the hell is Tyler Lane? Well, Tyler Lane, it turns out, is the mystery roommate. Tyler Lane is the co-signer of the lease at 5078 Lacey Road. So it turns out Amos did, in fact, have a roommate. It was this kid from Milwaukee who nobody knows, nobody has ever heard of. So that mystery gets solved. It just kind of opens up a new mystery as to why did he sign a lease, you know, like 10 days before, you know, 15 days before they're set to move in. Then he never moves in. So Margie doesn't meet Destin until the following day, November 16th. And when they find Gnosis, Margie lets Destin take Gnosis home for the night. She returns the next day with Gnosis. Margie starts having kind of this bad feeling about Destin and doesn't let her take Gnosis home that night. She had actually given Gnosis to the woman who runs the kennel, and it would take Gnosis too. Now, this is where Margie learns about the story of Jake Statfield and this missing load of $90,000 worth of marijuana, because two other women approach her and say, hey, this Destin girl's been telling us this story. You got to come and hear this. Well, Margie goes over. Destin tells her the story that she's just told these other two women. And Margie goes right to the police and tells them the story. I mean, this is big. This is the first-hand account of anything, you know, anybody pointing fingers at somebody who could potentially have had motive to do something to Amos. Well, the police kind of sit on it. You know, from the last episode, Shannon Morgan doesn't even contact Destin for, what, another 6 days? And when Margie asks Shannon Morgan about her conversation with Destin Lane later on, Morgan tells Margie, well, Destin told me she was talking about a different Jake. So Destin, in essence, has changed her story, which any police officer, I mean, any rational-minded person knows, you know, that's kind of a red flag. But even more than that, though, she tells a story about Big Jake Stadfeld owing Amos this money. She tells it to Brent, she tells it to Margie, she tells it to other people. She tells Shannon Morgan she was talking about a different Jake. Margie can't get Destin to ever go back to the story. She won't touch it. Come to find out later on, Destin Lane and Jake Stadfeld actually know each other. What that's about, at this point, they don't know, but it's a huge red flag.
As Margie tells, Detective Morgan seemed rather cavalier regarding Destin's inconsistent statements, fibs, and emotional outbursts. The record shows Detective Morgan doesn't contact Destin again until June, by which time she has moved out of state. Because Destin Lane was the only witness who could speak to Amos's intent to confront Stadfeld, Morgan may have looked past obvious issues around her star witness. Some of the theories dove straight into the macabre. The only unsolicited theory put to use by detectives was that Amos could have been the target of a revenge killing in response to his father's testifying on the prosecution's behalf in a federal drug case. According to Shannon Morgan's first search warrant of the investigation, Terry Boot Mortier's involvement in the meth trade was on the Wisconsin and Minnesota sides of the Mississippi. Margie gave Nathan a glimpse of life with Boot in Spooner.
So, after you get home from the hospital, where do you go?
Trailer. Yep. Down by the river, trailer. I mean, it was that we didn't have running water.
No?
Nope. No running water. Bringing home the baby. It was like definitely living off the land. So, then we had electricity, though. But
you gardening stuff?
Boot did. Boot was a big gardener, yeah. I would take care of the produce, but I didn't do any of that because I don't know any of that. I'm not good at that, and I don't know any of that, but he did that end of it. Yeah, he was really good at that. And we had chickens, goats, ducks, a burrow, two sheep, dogs. I think that's it. Yeah. He came out to our place. It was, like, horrible. I mean, you know, my parents were like, I'm sure that they left going, oh, my God, because he'd come out to our place, there'd be, like, dead animals hanging from trees because it would be, you know, boot hunted and fished. And so, you know, like a turtle, you have to let that hang in the blood. have to joke. So they'd be, and do, you know, smoking a lot of pot, so he'd start something and never finish. So it'd be like skulls and carcasses and half clean ducks. And yeah, it was like that. But yeah. Yeah, you know, as a typical bean broke smoking pot up north, so you did anything you could to, you know, make money. I don't think he was selling pot. I mean, I didn't know if he was. I don't believe he was. I didn't see any of that money. He was logging.
Brent says Amos compartmentalized his family as he did his friends and associates. Big Jake also did not know much about Amos's family or even his upbringing. But in the 18 months leading up to November 8th, 2004, Amos confided in nearly everyone about his father's incarceration.
His dad got busted and he was really down in the dumps about that.
Margie doesn't pull punches when discussing the vacuum Amos's father left in his son's life. While going through his things after he'd gone missing, Margie found things that suggested that Amos and Boot had been in contact. Jacob Faulkner met Boot inside the federal prison in Duluth, Minnesota.
Amos was a self-proclaimed redneck, even though he was much more of a hippie than a redneck. He reclaimed stories of his dad shooting squirrels off their porch and cooking them. So, and I actually met his dad when I was in prison. He didn't want to talk about Amos. He didn't really want to talk much because he was a much older guy and didn't really know me from anybody else there. Could have been lying to him for all he knew, but, when I did just see him, you know, interacting with his friends, he seemed like a pretty nice guy. I didn't really get to hear too much about Amos or him or anything, but what can you do?
Keith Burney told police that Amos was upset about his father's incarceration when Amos visited Keith on November 7th, the day before he went missing. Jake Stadfeld says Amos was often let down by their relationship.
And Amos never even talked to me about his mother. I mean, I didn't even know that he had a close relationship with her. He talked to me a lot about his father, who was a fuck up and in drugs and on a Christmas tree thing. And I mean, we definitely had long conversations about his father, but never once could I remember having a conversation about his mother.
Do you get the sense he was close to his dad?
I get the sense that he really wanted to be closer to his dad, and I get the sense that he tried a lot to be close to his dad. I could be wrong about that, too, but the way that he talked about his dad, it was just different. He was just like, you know, I remember him, you know, going up to this Christmas tree farm or something to see him, and I had the feeling that he, you know, wanted to be closer with his old man, but I don't really know. I just remember, I mean, we never had a conversation about his mother. I didn't even know his mother lived in Madison. But I know that his old man lived up north, and he's got busted for meth, I think, and he owned a Christmas tree farm. Is all that true?
Brent, who knew Amos for 7 years, didn't know that Amos had a sister until they met at the search. He said that you could tell that she and her brother had fallen from the same tree.
I guess the whole family, they just have this Margie and Amos and Seneca, yeah, just way above them, though. Put you at ease.
Oh, you're cool, Chris.
That's cool.
It is cool. Yeah, Margie's cool.
Margie's super cool. Margie's super cool.
Brent says that investigators have treated Margie the way that parents of missing adults are often treated by police, who become annoyed with the phone calls, questions, and criticisms.
It's a shame that the forces that be just use her name because they want, like, they told me that they want nothing more than to put her in and find what happened to their son there. She's their driving force. But as I know you've seen personally and heard, and I mean, I know that people that have been called into their presence have personally told me that they actually, when they bring up Monty, that they've been jumped on, right? This isn't about her. Don't bring it up.
The harder that investigators squeezed Amos's friends, the more refined their suspicions around everyone became. Brent Delzer wasn't a murder suspect per se, but the line between material witness and accessory is a fine one. And Detective Morgan was convinced that Brent, after giving several statements, still knew more than he was letting on. Given the preponderance of evidence around Stadfeld, no one would blame you for expecting murder charges to be forthcoming. Jacob Faulkner essentially was downgraded to being an accessory after the fact. It appeared that Big Jake had stolen Amos's pot, then murdered him when confronted or perhaps threatened in some way. Amos yelling at Stadfeld, followed by Stadfeld's calls to a gun shop, the ping off the Blaney Road cell tower around the time Amos went missing, the unaccounted time for in Portage the following day, never mind the bevy of false and self-incriminating statements. Rather than help search for his friend, Big Jake was lawyering up.
How often do they come talk to you?
They don't talk to me at all.
No.
They don't want to talk to them without a lawyer to shit.
Yeah.
There's no reason for them. There's no reason for them to come and talk to me. They think they know that without a lawyer president being informed that they want to talk to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. Why waste their time, huh?
No, if they want to, they're more than welcome to come. I have nothing to say without a destined set of meeting in which I want to know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say, never him, and it won't say anything without my lawyer's advice. Unfortunately for me, you can't always trust what your lawyer to say, because apparently if I would have just waited 2 days and gone to the grand jury, I'd have immunity.
The John Doe?
Yeah,
the John Doe.
No.
Yeah, that's the thing I didn't quite understand from the evidentiary hearings. It sounded like you and Brent both, had you testified at the John Doe, you could have pled the fifth, at which point the judge would have compelled your testimony by granting you immunity, and then
right.
It would have been more formal.
Well, I was told that this, that little thing that we were doing was my John Doe.
Okay.
That time was on the essence, but this was in effect my John Doe hearing.
The Doe is in a courtroom, right? I mean, it's supposed to be in a courtroom. It's before a judge.
It's supposed to be in the courtroom, but my lawyer agreed to it and said, yeah, this is okay, this is going to work out, because the cops wanted to talk to me so bad, except I'm saying time was on the essence. They're also saying that, I wasn't compelled to talk with them on that night, but they were raiding my house, making stories to the newspaper, telling me, what's the difference between now and 2 days from now, every second counts. Compulsion, I think, was incredibly evident.
How soon after the disappearance was that?
That was about 6 months.
Okay. The last time you saw Amos, how was he? Like, how was his mood? Well, I mean, anything you can say about the last time you saw him?
I honestly thought that he was fine.
This call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time. Thank you for using IC Solutions. You may begin speaking now.
Hey, what's up, man?
I wanted to dive into that a little bit more. The week, about the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to, that week, I mean, Amos was a bit more, he was a little bit more edgy and a bit more nervous, but he was never the kind of guy that really, as far as I ever knew, that would, freak out or anything.
Some of those early reports by the investigators made it sound that he was freaking out, that...
I agree with you. I definitely agree with you there, and I definitely agree that he was a little bit more on edge, but the last time I saw him, it appeared to me that he had everything figured out, that everything was cool. That's what I told them as well. There was no, it was like, okay, everything's fine. I mean, that's how I felt about it, but, I couldn't tell. I don't know what he was saying to other people, and I don't know what was going on. I don't think, I really can't comment on what he was doing with other people or anything like that.
Yeah.
That would just be asinine for me to say, it was different with me than he was with other people. I mean, he never was violent towards me or lashed out at me. I don't know. I just don't know. I just don't know. If there's one person that I ever knew that could leave and go off the grid and never talk to a human person again, it would be Amos.
Did think he would do that to his mom, though?
Huh?
Do you think he would do that to his mom?
No, I don't think anybody would do that to their mom. But, you know, then last year, that Call of the Wild movie came out with that dude, you know, and he, like, left his whole life behind and just, you know, went walkabout.
Yeah, do you think eventually, like, somebody would find something, but there's just fucking nothing? You know?
I think that's why some of us, I mean, maybe I'm just disillusioned, or maybe I'm just an idiot, but, you know, something, I just, you know, and the mother thing comes into it. You know, if I ever disappeared, would I have contact with my mother? Yes, I would. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think anybody who went walkabout and went off the grid or whatever would, I think, but again, I mean, to say that Amos and I were friends is the most asinine thing I've ever heard in my life. I mean, and Amos and I used to get together at the recording studio, just me and him, and play drums, and he would play the fucking, the fucking mouse harp, and he'd play harmonica, and we'd record stuff, and it was, you know, to say that he and I were not close is a fucking absolute lie, and it actually disgusts me when I read this thing where the judge says it's obvious to me that they didn't know each other. It's absolutely ridiculous. I can tell you six or seven people that worked at the den with us that know that when you worked at the den, you were trying to, it was a family situation. They're all the kids that worked there. We all knew each other. We all, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody was into music, and everybody was into partying, and nobody was excluded, and nobody, you know what I mean? It was to make a statement that we didn't know each other, that we weren't fucking called friends, is ridiculous. On top of it, the kid comes to my fucking wedding, and he's such a funny dude that, you know, he threw the most money in the hat to dance with my wife, but then didn't want to dance with my wife because he just didn't feel right about it. That's just him. It wasn't any offensive thing or like I would get mad at it. It was just him. He was like, okay, I remember he come up to me and he gave me this wicked smile, this wicked joker thing where his face would come up and he's like, yeah, I just threw $20 in the hand. And I was like, why aren't you dancing? And I was like, go dance with my fucking wife. And he's like, no, it's not my thing. No, it's just not. And I was like, all right, let's get a drink. You know, I mean, that was the thing. To say that we weren't friends is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. On so many levels, I just don't even know it.
So emotionally, when you found out that he was missing, and obviously at some point it had to become clear that things weren't looking good for him, I mean, what goes through your head emotionally? How do you respond to that emotionally?
I think you can ask, you know, anybody that knew me, but especially my wife. I mean, I was wrecked up. I was scared. I don't know how to explain it. I'm getting a little worked up on it right now. It was a weird feeling. And I don't know how to explain it. It was repulsion. It was just weird. It was just like I didn't know what was going on. I don't know what to say. It's still weird to not know.
Yeah.
Like I said, my wife and I, probably won't, you know, once a month. I think we just hope that, you know, one day he'll show up. I still punch him in the fucking head. Well, that's probably as far as I can do it, but I don't even know if I would. I mean, I wanted to punch some of my friends real, real bad.
Between November 2004 and May 2005, investigators executed 17 search warrants on property belonging to or rented by Amos, Jacob, and Big Jake Stadfeld. Nearly 100 statements were given by roughly 30 witnesses. Local reporters began running stories about Mortier's potential links to the marijuana trade, which made no sense to Margie, given Amos's precarious, at best, financial health. The fact that he needed $1,200 to help pay his rent, but had $90,000 in weed go missing seemed preposterous. Rather, Margie found it more plausible that he had slipped into a disassociative fugue and needed medical attention.
He was probably 6 or 7. Yeah, he was thrown up, so I know he had a concussion. Then he had another thing happen when he was a freshman in high school. I came around the corner, and I saw Amos on the ground, and his bike seat was twirling. And I go, Amos, what happened? Did you hit some gravel? You know how you could hit gravel on the bike and tip over? And he said, no. It just, I don't know what happened. He had no idea what happened to him. Well, I think he probably blacked out.
How many years later was this?
7.
Okay.
About 7.
So around the same time, yeah, though, he was fell down the stairs, hit his head.
No, 7 years later.
Oh,
he's a freshman
years.
In high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, so when he disappeared, well, and then he's, as an adult, well, even in high school, he had neck and back. Chronic pain all the time, and here he had it, and he used to do here, you know, he went and did the acupressure and puncture and did all that massage and all that stuff, you know, but he was in pain a lot, and I didn't realize he was having headaches. He never said headaches to me. He told me about his neck and back, but he never said he was having headaches, but I know that he was because it was that extra strength Excedrin for migraines in his house at Lacey Road, and it's like, that's very unusual for him because he doesn't buy stuff over the counter. And his uncle asked me about that, and I asked Dominic, and Dominic said, he drove over to his house, like, he was fine on the phone. He got there like 20 minutes later when he was done over off of Hillgale there, Amos did. Dominic got there, and he's like down on the floor, like, just clutching his head from head pain. Yeah, and then Amos's uncle told me that he had cluster headaches when he was a young adult, too. Eventually, said they just went away as he got older. So, I mean, for Amos to have a brain dysfunction and take off like that disassociative fugue, which is, you know, documented, it happened, was not a theory that seemed so far-fetched. Mm-hmm. You know, his chronic pain and all that headache.
In the weeks since the search ended, Detectives Morgan and Bongiovanni ramped up the pressure on those they believed had information to help them establish that Amos had more than likely gone missing involuntarily. Although detectives were getting a better handle on who everybody was, there still was so much they didn't know. Rumors spread, and at times could be like a plague infecting the investigation. The rumors around Dirk, for example, may have led to a lot of time wasted since a fair amount of the information Jacob Faulkner had assembled, such as Dirk's recent legal trouble, struggles with addiction, and the fact that Dirk was among the last people to see Amos when they hiked, not camped, on November 6, 2004. What no one at the Inferno knew was that detectives were sitting on a glut of information supporting their suspicions around Brent Delzer, Jacob Faulkner, and Big Jake Stadfeld, who they now believed were aware of something that was supposed to happen on November 8, 2004. But what? Amos himself left a clue when he called a friend while leaving school that day. Dominic had the day off of work and told Amos he would swing by on his way home. In October 2006, Dominic told a federal grand jury what he told police in November 2004 when they asked about that call, which was that Amos said he needed to call his propane supplier to discuss a billing issue and that he had some business to take care of later. The assistant U.S. attorney asked the friend several times while on the stand if Amos seemed distressed or hopeless. The witness replied that Amos seemed to be in good spirits. What happened between 1:15 p.m. and 4 p.m. was the million-dollar question. As 2004 drew to a close, it seemed as if the answer to that question was, if not locked away inside their brains, then each of them held pieces to the puzzle. Remember in episode 1 when Dirk and Marty show up at Brent's house because he wouldn't answer their phone calls? That night, Brent told them that he had been worried about Amos over the previous week and that he had gone to his mother's house because he was so distressed. Detectives also discovered that Brent had called Amos over 40 times that week.
I'm neurotic. I found out, because that's the first time I've ever had my best friend up and straight disappear without a fucking trace. So, I found out that when that situation happens, I am neurotic. I'll call you up and down. I'll call you 4 times in fucking 30 seconds if you don't answer. Like, after a time. That is a matter of conjecture. That apparently proves that I've fucking done something evil or knew something was going to happen because I called him a relentless amount of time. Like after that first Monday, I just kept calling him. It's what I do. If I'm bored and my brain is just wandering and I haven't talked to you and I really want to talk to you because I told you to talk to me, yeah, I'll call you. Call you. I'll hang up and just push the send button again twice just to call. And yeah, fucking, I didn't really know you. I guess the first indication that I had that things were bad was when the four guys showed up.
Long before it became widely accepted as fact that Amos was involved in the marijuana trade, Brent had admitted to detectives early on that he had sold marijuana for Amos, hundreds of pounds of it, in fact. What he did not tell detectives was that Amos had promised to introduce him to the source of the marijuana that he distributed. Friends he had shared this with during the search, and those who were aware of it before the disappearance, eventually passed this information on to detectives. When the prosecutor who initiated the John Doe subpoenaed Brent's best friend and former girlfriend, Bonnie, because he had been immunized against prosecution for being truthful with their questions. But when Bonnie provided information that Brent had not, investigators considered it a breach of his immunity deal. Although the information Brent withheld wasn't relevant to finding Amos, it did become material. Hungry for more, the questioning Bonnie underwent was relentless.
Watching you on the stand-up in June was one of the most heartbreaking things I'd ever seen. Well, what goes through your mind when you're up there and you're seeing Brent and Dan Graber's asking you questions that can potentially send your friend to jail for a long time?
There were quite a few people that believed in me and gave me the strength to get back to what I'd been through when I was younger. And to sit there and ultimately be destroyed in a lot of the words that come out of my mouth. It's torture. I mean, me and my daughter stuck a knife in my arm because that's what it feels like.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished.
When the United States Attorney's Office granted a referral to state prosecutors to seek indictments against Amos's co-conspirators in his distribution operation, it ballooned from being a local homicide to a sprawling federal drug trafficking investigation. This was not your normal investigation, however. Normally, drug investigations begin at a point and move upward. Although several eventually were convicted of playing a role in this operation, the investigation had two men in its crosshairs, Brent Delzer and Jake Stadfeld. In the federal system, the suspects of a crime receive a target letter putting them on notice that they're under investigation by the United States government. Nathan sat with Brent a couple days after Detectives Morgan and Bon Giovanni delivered his target letter to him at work.
I'd also like to get a letter like that.
Fucked up. They come onto your job.
What's
that? They fucking
want
to talk to you.
They give you that letter on the on your job?
Yeah. Yeah, they fucking...
Oh, wow.
They want to do it right there. I mean, like, I'm sorry, like...
Good. Well, we get...
I mean, yeah, I'm a window cleaner. I'm a supervisor at a window cleaning company.
Yeah.
And people think of that as what they may, you know, like, fucking...
Oh. Yeah,
believe me, when I was a little kid, fucking, I didn't think of being a window cleaner. But still, it's my job. And I am, fucking, I have excelled at it. And I am at the position that I am. And I do respect fucking... Sorry, swear. I do respect, you know, my clients. And I do respect the level of professionalism that I make sure that I portray to my clients, and the way that I handle myself on a job site, and to be just waylaid right there in this goddamn entranceway.
It was as if this entire investigation was beginning anew, only this time detectives came armed with evidence provided by the suspects themselves, which also meant that those who may have been on the periphery in the eyes of state prosecutors were now potential co-conspirators in a narcotics trafficking investigation. If anyone thought Morgan and Bon Giovanni were openly hostile, they obviously hadn't met Special Agent Jerry Becca from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, also known as the DEA.
You knew Jerry Becca, obviously. Yeah. What's he like? I haven't met him.
He's perfect for his job.
Yeah.
To this day, investigators believe Jake Stadfeld murdered Amos Mortier on November 8, 2004. They say that the evidence shows that Jake Stadfeld murdered Amos when confronted over the $90,000 worth of marijuana that Stadfeld had allegedly stolen from Amos. Search warrants executed in April 2005 state that Stadfeld pinged off a cell tower near Amos's house around the time that Amos's cell phone powered down. The following day, Stadfeld's cell phone pinged the same tower just after 10 a.m. While driving to his mother's house 90 minutes north of Madison, Stadfeld pinged cell towers in the city of Portage, about 10 minutes east of the interstate. Stadfeld, they say, has never provided an explanation for what he did in Portage that morning. What the search warrants don't say, but the police reports do, is that Amos told Stadfeld on November 4, 2004, that unless he came up with $20,000 by Monday, November 8, 2004, bad things were going to happen when Amos's East Coast supplier arrived in Madison. Stadfeld said that he gave Amos a little over $10,000 between then and the last time he saw him on the evening of November 7, 2004, the night before he went missing. Stadfeld said that Amos told him to be on standby on November 8, 2004, in case the East Coast boys wanted to speak with him. When Amos hadn't called by that afternoon, Stadfeld says that he drove by Amos's house and observed Amos's two vehicles parked in front of the garage. When he still hadn't heard from Amos the following morning, Stadfeld drove to his mother's house in Mauston, bringing his little girl along with him. Since that time, Stadfeld has expected a bullet to the back of his head ever since. That brings us to the end of part 3 of Amos Mortier's story. We had planned to make this a 3-part series, but now it has become 4. In part 4, we will explore a theory that investigators seem to have ignored all along. If you would like to contact me, my Twitter handle is @TheVanishedPod. I have a Facebook page and a private discussion group that everyone is welcome to join. I would like to thank you for your patience while we worked on this episode. It took longer than I expected, but unfortunately I got sick. You could probably tell that my voice still isn't 100% better, but I'm hoping it'll be there by the time I record part 4. So keep an eye out for the final chapter of this story coming to you very soon.
I mean, I know where this all kind of leads to. It's like whether he was in the pot world and stealing and everything like that. I think it's all pretty much established that he was like selling pot or something. But he was definitely not like a gangster. Definitely wasn't like somebody that's pushing buttons. He's kind of the guy who probably sold pot as an outlet so they could do his other things in life, you know. It was an odd thing. It was like he went out after his dog or something like that, right? Or his dog was there still, and there was like a record still playing on the phonograph, like as if he just stepped out, which makes it look more like an abduction, you know, leave your record player going, especially Yeah, those guys do a lot of audiophiles, you know, a lot of vinyl and, you know, the whole thing about it is, like, if you could say it's like in the early years of Magnus, the pot mafia was very good to my restaurant. I actually believe in them more than I believe in, like, the drug wars that go on over our Mexican border and the south and everything like that. A lot of times that world pops up back at him. I hope he shows up someday. Yeah. He's been hanging out in Mexico the whole time, making everybody scared.
At night, I started researching immediately on the computer, you know, the internet. Thank God, I don't know how parents ever did this before they had the internet, because I was just running, well, when I found out about Staffel, you know, trying to find information on him. I was trying to find information. I see Amos's name out there. That's how I found that organic volunteer site. And so, yeah, that's what I was doing every night. I was just on my computer.
Any day I can manage to keep it from, you know, getting in there and my head taking over is a good day. It's the hard times are when any article comes out, it always stops me dead in my tracks. Really, the whole day goes to crap.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal, or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.